Hello, and welcome to another episode of Into the Killing. If this is your first episode, we want to thank you for checking us out. Of course, if you listen to other episodes, or all of them, we really appreciate you, and we're so happy that you're continuing to listen. Today's case begins in August 1977. On August 4th, 1977, President Jimmy Carter signed legislation that created the United States Department of Energy. On August 10th, David Berkowitz, the serial killer known as the Son of Sam, was arrested after a year-long murder spree that left six people dead and nine others wounded. On August 16th, legendary musician, actor, and cultural icon Elvis Presley died on the toilet at his home, Graceland, in Memphis, Tennessee. Presley had been addicted to opiates, and this made him constipated. It's believed that he strained while trying to have a bowel movement, and this put a great amount of pressure on his heart and his aorta. As a result, he died of a heart attack. The King of Rock and Roll was just 42 years old. Fifty-eight-year-old Mary Parsh lived in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, with her husband. Her husband recently had a pacemaker installed, so he was in the hospital. Their 27-year-old daughter, Brenda Parsh, who lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, came home to help Mary around the house. Brenda was considered a beautiful young woman. She had won several beauty pageants. In Milwaukee, she worked as a fashion buyer for stores. On August 15, 1977, another one of Mary's daughters called a neighbor because she had not been able to get a hold of her mother for a few days. The neighbor went over, and the front door was ajar. She walked into a bedroom, and on an unmade bed, she found the dead bodies of the mother and daughter. The neighbor called the police. The nude bodies were lying side by side on the bed. Their wrists had been bound behind their back with electrical wires. Brenda had been raped. Then they were both shot in the head with a small caliber gun. It was later determined to be a .380 caliber handgun. There were no signs of a break-in or forced entry. The police thought that the women may have come home and interrupted a burglary. However, nothing had been stolen. Another theory was that they knew the killer and let him into the home. But unfortunately, it was not long before the case went cold. Months later, on November 17, 1977, the dead body of a woman was found at a highway rest stop just outside McClure, Missouri. She was identified as 21-year-old Sheila Cole. Cole was a student at Southeast Missouri State University in Cape Girardeau. She was majoring in zoology and minoring in chemistry. Cole had been raped and shot twice in the head with a .380 caliber gun. The police thought that she was killed the night before and her body was dumped. Cole was last seen by friends the night before her body was found. She was going shopping at a Walmart in Cape Girardeau. Her car was found abandoned in the parking lot of the Walmart, so the police speculated that she might have been kidnapped there. The police initially thought that Cole's murder might be connected to the murders of the Parshes. Both Sheila Cole and Brenda Parsh were raped, and all three victims were shot in the head with a .380 caliber handgun. However, the police didn't find any suspects. So like the Parsh's case, Cole's murder went cold as well. In May 1978, 51-year-old Virginia Witt lived with her husband, David Witt, in Marion, Illinois. On May 12th, David went out for lunch with a friend, and Virginia went grocery shopping. David arrived home at about 1 p.m., and he found the groceries on the kitchen counter. In the bedroom, he found the nude, dead body of his wife. A large knife from the kitchen was embedded in her chest. She had also been slashed across the stomach with the knife. The medical examiner determined that she had been raped. The killer also had strangled her with his hands. Tragically, no arrests were made in the case. the police had no idea that Virginia Witt's murder was connected to the murders committed in and around Cape Girardeau. The cities were 55 miles apart, but they were in two different states. Also, Virginia was not shot like the other three victims. In March 1979, 29-year-old Joyce Tharp lived alone in an apartment in Paducah, Kentucky. On March 23rd, Tharp's aunt went to her home and found the apartment empty. What really troubled her was that her apartment had a broken window. So she reported her niece missing. The next day, Tharp's new dead body was found amongst the garbage cans behind a church a few miles from her home. She had been struck on the head and strangled to death. She had also been sexually assaulted. For several reasons, the police saw no connection between Tharp's murder and the other four murders. Tharp was a black woman, and the other victims were white. Tharp was kidnapped from her home, and while Sheila Cole was abducted, she was taken from a public place. Also, the other crimes happened in Missouri and Illinois. Tharp was kidnapped, and her body was found in Kentucky. The police didn't have any suspects in Tharp's murder. Like the other cases, it soon went cold. In April 1979, 51-year-old Myrtle Rupp lived alone in South Temple, Pennsylvania. She had lived alone since her husband died 5 years earlier. Rupp was a head nurse and supervisor in the obstetrics and gynecology department at a hospital in Reading, Pennsylvania. 2 months earlier, Rupp had orthopedic surgery and she had been recovering at home. The last time anyone saw her was on April 15th. On April 17th, a neighbor was curious about what might have happened to her, so they made their way into her home. They found her dead body in her bedroom. Her wrists and ankles had been bound with sashes. She had been raped and strangled to death. Once again, the murders were not connected. But if they were, would it have done any good? Would it have led the police to a suspect? Unfortunately, these questions would later haunt investigators because the killer was far from done hunting. On January 26, 1982, 57-year-old Marjorie Call, who lived in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, went to work. For 42 years, she had been a bookkeeper for the department store, Woolworths. When she was done work, she went out with her card club. She played cards with them all evening. Whenever she played with them, someone would follow her home afterward. It was something they started doing after her husband died in 1978 and she started living alone. When she got inside, she would turn on a light to indicate that she got inside safely. The night of January 26, 1982 was no different. The next morning, Marjorie Call didn't show up for work. Her co-workers called her brother and asked him to check on her. In the bedroom, he found her nude dead body face down on the bed. Her wrists were tied behind her back with a leather cord. Call's brother immediately alerted the police. The police discovered that the window in the bathroom in the back of the house was broken. So it's believed that's how the killer entered the home. The medical examiner determined that she had been raped and strangled to death. It wasn't long before her case went cold as well. In spring 1982, 23-year-old Deborah Shepherd was a senior at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois. She was majoring in marketing. She was just a few weeks away from graduating. On Thursday, April 8th, 1982, Shepherd was in her apartment alone. That weekend was Easter weekend, and she was expecting a visit from her family. That evening, Shepherd's boyfriend stopped by her apartment to say hi. He found her nude dead body on her bedroom floor. He ran to another apartment and he called 911. The detectives found a window that had been removed from her apartment Switchblade, that's how the killer entered the apartment. They also noticed that the phone line had been cut. An autopsy was performed. What was odd was that the pathologist did not see any homicidal marks on her body. So the pathologist thought she might have had a medical episode and died. The police released a statement saying that no foul play was suspected. Shepard's father refused to believe the findings. He knew his daughter was a healthy young woman who didn't die from natural causes. He thought that the authorities were possibly trying to sweep her death under the rug, possibly because she was black. Shepard's dad arranged for her body to be sent to Chicago, Illinois, for a second autopsy. The second autopsy was done 5 days after the murder. The pathologist found deep bruising on her neck, so he concluded that she had been strangled to death. Also, around the same time, the police received the results from the rape kit. Semen was found on oral swabs. So Deborah Shepard's death was ruled a homicide. The police interviewed several men who knew Shepard. They all took polygraph exams and were eliminated as suspects. So her case went cold as well. The police had no reason to suspect that Shepard's murder was connected to the other homicides. On June 21, 1982, the police were called to the home of 65-year-old Mildred Wallace in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. Wallace was an office manager and she lived alone. When she was found, she was face down on her bed. Her wrists had been bound behind her back and she had been blindfolded. She was also sexually assaulted. She was then shot in the right temple with a .38 caliber handgun. It's believed that the killer entered through a window at the rear of the house. The police immediately saw connections between the murders of Mildred Wallace and Marjorie Call. They were both older white women who lived alone. The killer entered their homes through the rear of the house. Both women were found face down in their beds with their wrists tied behind their back, and they had been sexually assaulted. The murders happened about 6 months apart from each other. Also, Wallace and Call lived about 5 blocks from each other. The police also thought that the murders might be connected to the murders of Mary and Brenda Parsh, which happened 5 years earlier. Mary, Wallace, and Call all lived within a mile of each other. Also, like Wallace, Brenda and Mary had been shot with a .380 caliber handgun. But once again, the police couldn't find any suspects in the cases. Then, after the 9 murders in 5 years, the killing suddenly stopped. Of course, the police had no idea that the murders were all connected. The only commonalities between the victims was that they were all adult women. Some of the victims were older and others were younger. They were black women and white women. The crimes were all very different from each other. Other than that, they had all been sexually assaulted. Some were shot and others were strangled or stabbed. A few were kidnapped and others died in home invasion. Also, the murders happened in Missouri, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. One major commonality between all 9 murders is that the police didn't have a suspect in any of the cases. So for years, they all sat cold. Nearly 29 years after the first murder, in May 2006, a strange twist of fate started to bring some closure. A lieutenant with the Carbondale Police Department, Paul Eccles, was being interviewed for the A&E television show Cold Case Files. The episode was about the August 1981 murder of 21-year-old Susan Shoemake. He was being interviewed with a DNA expert named Suzanne Kidd. Eccles mentioned to Kidd that he wanted her to look at another case, the murder of Deborah Shepard. He said that the problem was that he didn't have too much DNA to work with. Kidd said she would look at his evidence. Eccles asked his superior if he could bring the evidence to Kidd. His superior told him to focus on his current work. A year later, Eccles was promoted and he was able to bring the evidence to Kidd. She found a tiny speck of semen on Shepard's t-shirt. It was more semen than they originally thought they had. They were able to create a DNA profile from the speck. In August 2007, 25 years after Deborah Shepard's murder, the DNA was run in a state DNA database. A match was found. It belonged to a 62-year-old convicted sex offender named Timothy Kreicher. Kreicher had lived a double life. He had worked as an EMT and helped countless people. Female co-workers said that he was a nice and caring guy. He'd warned them never to walk alone at night and be wary of strangers. He never lost his temper or got angry. But he also had a horrifying criminal record for violence against women. Kreicher was born in November 1944 in Allenstown, Pennsylvania. As a child, he developed an unhealthy emotional and sexual obsession with his mother. When he was 13, he became a peeping Tom. In 1962, when he was 17 years old, he enlisted in the Navy. The following year, he committed at least 2 rapes in Illinois. During his first known rape, he stabbed his victim with a pair of scissors. She was nearly killed, but survived. In June 1963, Kreicher was convicted of rape, and he was sentenced to 25 to 50 years in prison. When he was 29, he became an inmate emergency medical technician at Cairo Padco Community Hospital. Kreicher took classes in prison, and in June 1974, he graduated from community college. After graduating, he became an inmate EMT at Union County Hospital in Anna, Illinois. In 1976, he was released from prison at the age of 31. He settled in Carbondale, Illinois, and started taking classes at Southern Illinois University. He also got a job as an ambulance driver. In February 1979, Kreicher was arrested again. For the past 2 years, he had been sexually abusing his landlord's daughter. She was just 13 years old when the abuse started. For the abuse, in August 1979, Kreicher was sentenced to 2 years in prison. In 1980, psychiatrists recommended him for early release. In June 1981, he was released from prison. In December 1981, Kreicher graduated from Southern Illinois University with a degree in Administration of Justice and a minor in psychology. In spring 1983, after a series of assaults on girls and women in Allentown, Pennsylvania, 37-year-old Kreicher was arrested again. He was sentenced to 2.5 to 5 years in prison. In 1988, he was released after serving the full 5 years. He was then transferred to a prison in Illinois for parole violations. While he was in prison there, he decided he didn't want to hurt anyone anymore. He thought that the best way to stop himself from hurting people was to stay in prison. So he stopped applying for parole. When his DNA was linked to the murder of Deborah Shepard, he was still in prison. Detective Paul Echols paid Kreicher a visit in prison. He initially denied having anything to do with Deborah Shepard's murder. So Echols showed Kreicher a lab report that showed that his DNA was found at the crime scene. Kreicher said that he didn't want to talk anymore and he would speak to his lawyer. So Echols left the prison. The next day, a prison official called Echols. He told him that Kreicher wanted to talk. So Echols talked to Kreicher again, and Kreicher admitted to raping and strangling Deborah Shepard. A detective in Cape Girardeau, Jimmy Smith, saw the news about Shepard's murder being solved. Cape Girardeau and Carbondale, where Shepard was killed, were only about 50 miles apart. Shepard was murdered 3 months after Marjorie Call was killed in Cape Girardeau, and 3 months before Mildred Wallace was killed in Cape Girardeau. Smith wondered if Kreiker could be responsible for those murders as well. They had DNA from both cases and a partial palm print from Wallace's murder. The DNA was a match to Kreiker, as was the palm print. In November 2007, Smith and Eccles interviewed Kreiker in prison. He denied committing any other murders. But then, a few days later, a plea deal was arranged. In exchange for confessing to all his crimes, the prosecutor would not seek the death penalty. So in December 2007, Smith and Eccles returned to the prison. They were shocked by what Kreiker told them. He said his first victims were Mary and Brenda Parsh. He said he had been stalking Mary and he thought she lived alone. He broke into her house while she was out and he was surprised when she returned home with her daughter. He ended up raping Brenda and killing them both. He kidnapped Sheila Cole from a Walmart parking lot in Cape Girardeau. He took her back to Carbondale, where he had a trailer. He raped her and then started driving her back to Carbondale. Along the way, he decided to kill her. He shot her at the rest stop and left her body there. He then broke into the home of Virginia Witt and killed her. Kreiker said that on March 23, 1979, he was cruising for a victim. He ended up in Paducah, Kentucky, and he saw Joyce Tharp sleeping through her window. He kidnapped her and took her to his trailer in Carbondale. He raped her and strangled her. He drove her body back to Paducah and dumped her body. About a month later, he stalked Merle Roop in South Temple, Pennsylvania. He then broke into her home when she wasn't there. When she returned home, he raped her and strangled her to death. He then murdered Marjorie Call, Deborah Shepherd, and Mildred Wallace. He had stalked all of them, and then he broke into their homes when they weren't there, and then killed them when they returned home. Kreiker said that he didn't have a victim type. He said he just wanted easy victims. He generally encountered his victims in parking lots. He would follow them home and watch them. He would make sure that a man wasn't living with them. Then, while they were out, he would break into their home and hide in a closet or in the shower. When they got home, he would attack them. Kreiker also confessed to dozens of other rapes. In one case, in 1981, he raped and stabbed a woman. A man named Grover Thompson was arrested and convicted of the crime. Thompson ended up dying in prison in 1996. Timothy Kreiker ended up pleading guilty to all the murders except for the murder of Joyce Tharp. She was his only victim in Kentucky. He was charged with Tharp's murder, but since he pleaded guilty to the other eight murders, the district attorney in Kentucky chose not to prosecute him. For the murder of Deborah Shepherd, Kreiker was sentenced to 40 years in prison. He was also given 40 years for the murder of Virginia Witt. For the five murders in Cape Girardeau, along with the rapes, he was given 13 consecutive life sentences. At the sentencing hearing, Kreiker said, "I don't know if I could have been so generous if I were in the same situation. Thank you for sparing my life." Finally, for the murder of Merle Rupp, he was given another life sentence. At the time of this recording, 77-year-old Timothy Kreiker is serving his sentence at the Pontiac Correctional Center in Pontiac, Illinois. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Our producer, fact-checker, and sound designer was Nell Cloutier. Recently, we launched a new channel called Paranormally Listed. On that channel, we discuss ghostly hauntings, UFO sightings, and encounters with cryptids. You can find it at youtube.com/paranormallylisted. Of course, we still have our original true crime channel, Criminally Listed. We have over 325 videos featuring bizarre but true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. But that's all for today. Thanks again for listening. Please take care of yourself and stay safe.